شامبيون العالم ميسي.
كويس كويس.
Today on Straight Talk Africa, the recent major social and political developments in the Sudan. Could this be a game changer? That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali. And today we are discussing the recent social and political development in the Republic of Sudan. Thousands of Sudanese demonstrators are continuing to rally in support of their demand for civilian rule in front of the army headquarters in Khartoum. The protesters are keeping the pressure on the military council to quickly transform to a civilian government following the ouster of longtime former President Omar Bashir. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more on this story.
The Sudanese Professionals Association, the chief organizer behind the protests, is urging people to head to the sit-in and defend it from any new attempts by the military to disperse the demonstrators. Protesters remain defiant after an attempt to break up their sit-in. They've been here outside the defense ministry since April 6. After removing Bashir, the military council announced that it would be setting up a transitional military council to run the country for up to 2 years. But demonstrators have strongly rejected that plan.
Our first demand is the need to form a civilian sovereign council with aggressive representation for limited tasks. This council must have limited tasks, which are the tasks of sovereignty only.
At the army headquarters, crowds remained camped outside the complex despite spur warnings of an attempt to disperse the sit-in. And Africa Union threatened to suspend Sudan if military fails to hand over power to civilians within 15 days.
African Union would further appeal probably to all stakeholders right now on the ground that more now than ever is time to engage in an inclusive dialogue to create the conditions that would make it possible to meet the aspirations of the Sudanese people to for democracy and good governance and restore constitutional orders.
Witnesses say several army vehicles had surrounded the area of the sit-in and that the troops were seen removing barricades, which demonstrators had put as part of a security measure.
We are Sudanese. We are looking forward for justice, for freedom, for democracy. And we thank all our people, our youth, our women for this a great factory.
We not believe in them. We're still in our revolution. Our demands are not met, and we're not gonna leave the Sudan until we get everything done. We hope that we can get civil government. We don't want any army government anymore in Sudan. We don't want the Islamic Party, the National Congress.
A 10-member delegation representing the protesters delivered a list of demands during talks with the council last weekend. According to a statement released by the Alliance for Freedom and Change Umbrella Group, the military council, however, has met with the political parties urging them to agree on an independent figure to be prime minister. Omar al-Bashir ruled Sudan with an iron fist for 30 years before he was deposed following mass protests that have rocked the country since mid-December. Bashir rose to power in a 1989 coup and has been one of Africa's long-term serving presidents. The United Nations Human Rights Office is calling on the Military Council to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, which has issued an arrest warrant for President Bashir for alleged war crimes committed nearly 15 years ago. World powers, including the United States, Britain, and Norway, have issued a joint statement calling for inclusive dialogue to effect a transition to civilian rule and democratic governance. Much sooner than 2 years, Meanwhile, thousands of people are vowing to continue the protests until a civilian government is established. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining me in the studio today are three distinguished guests. Amar Arutayeb, a Sudanese activist and former senior staffer at the Central Bank of Sudan. Ibrahim Babika, a Sudanese activist representing Gilifin, a Sudanese movement that is opposed to war, corruption, dictatorship, injustice, and discrimination against minorities. And last but not least, Paul Nantulia from the Africa Center of the Strategic Studies at the National Defense University here in Washington, D.C. And from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, we are joined by reporter Naba Mohideen and Ambassador Nur Erdin Sati, a former senior diplomat at the Sudanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Well, I have to say that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Let's go to, let's go to the Sudanese capital in Khartoum. Good evening, Naba.
Good evening.
How are you?
Very well.
Naba, give us a sense of the mood on the ground from your vantage point. Naba, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Could you please give us a sense of the mood on the ground from your vantage point? Naba, can you hear me? I'm afraid that we're experiencing some technical difficulties. Let's stay in Khartoum and get another perspective from Ambassador Nur Erdin Sati, who joins us via Skype from Khartoum. Good evening, Ambassador Sati.
Good evening, Chaka. How are you today?
I am hugely terrific. What is the mood like from your vantage point? Give us a sense of the mood.
Well, the mood in Khartoum let me start by saying thanking you for inviting me to your program. The mood in Khartoum is that of euphoria and cautiousness at the same time. The Sudanese people have made a great achievement by removing the dictatorial regime of President al-Bashir. As you said in your introductory remarks, demonstrators have been there for the last 4 months. And for the last week or so, they have been organized a sit-in in front of the army headquarters here in Khartoum, which resulted in toppling the regime and the army rallying to those protests. A military council has been constituted. But now, of course, what is happening is that there are intense consultations within the forces of freedom and change in order to see to it that power is transferred to the civilian authority. And according to what I have been told a few moments ago, these forces have handed in a letter to the military council in which they have expressed their demands and by constituting what I would call a legislative council, three layers of authority, a legislative council, a sovereignty council, and executive cabinet. So now these talks, negotiations have started and will be launched between the civilian party and the military party. And there is a lot of determination that power should be transferred to the civilians.
Ambassador Sati, how does it feel for you? You've been a sort of career diplomat with the Sudanese government for a long time, and I gather that you are now retired. You also worked for the United Nations. You've been living away for a very, very long time. How does it feel now that you are in Khartoum, the Sudanese capital, and you are actually having a front row seat as history unfolds?
Well, it's a feeling of satisfaction, of course, and it's a feeling of being vindicated for the years that we have been waiting for this regime to go. And of course, I have joined the Sudanese people in this protest, and I am very happy to see at this moment in history and in this moment of my own history that this is happening in Sudan, and to share the euphoria and happiness and the enthusiasm of those young women and boys who have made it possible. Thanks to their determination, to their imagination, their inventiveness, and their really, really resourcefulness that they have seen done away with this regime that has been around for too long. From my own perspective, I have witnessed the two previous uprisings in the October 1964 and April 1985, where I was actively involved within the Association of Diplomats in removing that regime. And I can say that this third uprising is unprecedented in the way it has been done, it has been organized. And I raise my hat to the young men and women who have achieved this. And we are here from our own perspective and our older generation, not to take their seats, but in order to see to it that they occupy properly their seats and that they move forward in the manner that they wish to do, and we are here to just to support them and provide them with the experience and expertise that we have when we are on our way out.
From what you have been able to experience as you interact to a lot of people, do you get the sense that most Sudanese that you have been at least able to interact with share the same feeling?
They absolutely do. This revolution has gone into each household. Even the young, you know, the young children, even the babies now, you know, are singing about this revolution. That's why I say it's unprecedented in many ways. This is a real social revolution that has affected everybody and touched every human being in Sudan. It is really a generalized sense of frustration from the former regime, a sense of injustice, deep injustice that have prevailed the whole nation and affected each and every individual. And that's why it's so great to see that everybody is contributing to it. The older generation, the medium generation, the younger generation, and even the very much younger generation. And that's why I'm saying it is really, 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 you know, very impressive. And that's what makes me confident that this revolution is going to achieve its objectives, because it's protected by the people, all the people, the different, you know, classes of the society, the different, you know, regions of the country, the different shades of opinion and diverse political, you know, affiliations are all there in order to protect and support the revolution and see to it that it achieves its lawful objectives.
What is particular? Is there anything specifically Sudanese, really, in as far as successful uprisings are concerned? Because Maybe you should share a secret, if there is any, really, because you seem to be doing very well when it comes to toppling generals in the Sudan, beginning with General Ibrahim Aboud back in 1964.
Well, there is no secret. There is no secret, you know. It is just that in moments of exception, the Sudanese know how to stand together. It's deep in our culture, that sense of solidarity, that sense of compassion and togetherness. We are good, as you rightly said, Chaka, in toppling military regimes and despotic regimes. But I would like us also to be more successful in sustaining what comes after. So I mean sustaining democracy. And for me, this is the real challenge now. As I turn my 73rd year, Chaka, I am pondering on the way in which the Sudanese can sustain and maintain their revolutions, not just become exceptional moments in their history, but they become moments that trigger off a longer generation of democracy. And that's what we need to do now, to see to it that this revolution, this change, is going to be durable and that is going to be sustainable. And it is in that sense that we need to operate and introduce profound changes, profound constitutional, institutional, political, social, cultural, intellectual, and mental changes in Sudan so that we will be able to maintain and sustain a democracy in Sudan. It's a real challenge to each and every one of us. We have to stop this vicious cycle of military uprising, followed by 5 or 6 years of democracy, then 6 or 16 or 30 years of despotic regimes. And for me, this is the challenge towards which we should direct all our attention and all our efforts intellectually, politically, constitutionally, socially, and culturally.
On that note, thank you very, very much, Ambassador Nur Eldin Busati, for your insight.
Thank you very much.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Now, for more on the situation in Sudan, let's go to Naba. Good evening, Naba. Good evening, Naba. Well, it looks like we are still experiencing some technical difficulties interacting with Naba from the Sudanese capital of Khartoum. Let me come at least for now here in the studio and interact with my panelists. You know, it's very interesting that we're talking about Sudan, and we are talking, of course, about Omar al-Bashir being toppled following 30 years of service, or at least 30 years of imposing himself upon the Sudanese people. How does it feel like a member of the Kandaka Club?
Actually, it is first... I want to just to speak a little bit about this uprising in the Sudan, which is historical, unprecedented, and had engaged all the age groups, and women and men and children in this uprising, and so as to topple down a dictator regime that ruled the government, ruled the country of Sudan for 30 years under a radical Islamic regime, while under a great big suppression and repression and deprivation of exercise of human rights, besides the country's economic situation kept deteriorating to the extent that had affected the livelihoods of the people to the extent they could not even being able to get the basic needs for their families and for themselves. So that is why the people had to go out and uprise and to stick to the principles they agreed upon, by which is the toppling down or of the dictator regime.
Now, Amar, we are experiencing something rather unusual on the African continent. And here we are talking about the role, the significant role played by your sisters, the women of Sudan. What can you tell us about the significance, for example, of Kandaka, the Nubian concept for warrior queens?
Yes, the women of Sudan are called Kandakas after their queens of then after their Nubian queens, for their strength, their empathy, their power, and their resilience. That is why they are called Kandakas, and this is what we witnessed in this revolution while they were leading the uprise and the demonstrations in the streets, in the cities, and in the villages. Because the Kandakas of our past are a motivational spirit to us, and are motivational figures, where they were very strong, where they ruled the Nubia and expanded even to West Asia, mm-hmm. in the before like centuries ago. And ruled, and about one Kandaka I recall that her name is Amanitor. This Amanitor, only by herself and the assistance with a brother or a husband, this is what we know, a male assisted her, was able to build 200 pyramids in her era. And she was able to conquer the Roman Empire in Egypt and to break his statue in Aswan while she was moving north. And that head of the statue was found lately in her temple in 2016, which she was so proud of, and she used to put it on her bedside when she sleeps.
Very interesting.
So that is why the Kandakas of Sudan are motivated by this spirit of their grand mothers, the Kandakas of the Nubian kingdom of Kush. So for this reason, the Sudanese women was so influential in her small environment, like the family, in her society, and in her village, and at the country as large. For example, at the level of the village, the Sudanese woman is a producer of food. Mm-hmm. The Sudanese woman is an educator of the children, the Sudanese woman is the one who cultivate the land. The Sudanese woman was the one who carries the water from the well or from the river on her head, mm-hmm. so as to feed and to feed her family and to nourish her children.
We'll talk about a little bit more about that later. Let me come to you, Ibrahim. Tell us a little bit about that iconic picture of the young lady, the 22-year-old lady, who happens to be a university student studying engineering and architecture. Is it Al-Salah?
Yes.
Al-Salah, standing on top of a white car at the Ministry of Defense headquarters. Mm-hmm. It sort of reminded me of another iconic picture when the Soviet Union was in the process of collapsing. You remember the picture of Boris Yeltsin standing on top of a tank?
Yes. Well, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't think, I mean, I can give that picture justice. That picture summed up a lot of things that happened, transpired, I mean, during this revolution. And it came all in one moment, one perfect moment, that the Kandaka was on top and everybody's listening. And that's exactly the role and the aspiration we look to, the leadership that we are lacking and we're looking for, I mean, to come from our woman partners. Because for so long, I mean, they've been oppressed. I mean, a lot of people have been marginalized and oppressed, and the women specifically, I mean, during the dictatorship, they were oppressed in the name of religion. And right now, I mean, to see this aspiration and perfect moment that symbolizes, I mean, our revolution, it's a great thing. But it also, I mean, we shouldn't undermine, I mean, the many, many other kandakat, I mean, that maybe had greater, I mean, chance, I mean, to be seen, but never been captured.
Never been captured.
I give them all credit. Whatever they are, whatever they what they did, I mean, they were part of that picture. And when we look at that picture, we see all of them, not only one person. So I hope, I mean, that's, I mean, give it the justice, I mean, that, or the same view we see that one moment.
We should point out, by the way, at least for the audience, that this is not really particularly unique for women to be able to be in the front line of the struggle and, in fact, help change some dictatorships.
Yes.
We saw it, for example, in the 1970s in Ghana, where the market women of Accra helped to topple another military dictator, Colonel Ignatius Achempong. We also saw gallant Liberian women helping to end the civil war in Liberia. When you look at this, Paul, what comes to mind? What would you, for example, say to some of those democratically challenged leaders who, at least according to Nigerians, would say seat tight presidents?
Yes, no, thank you. Thank you, Shaka. And it's really a pleasure to be here with Sudanese. I lived in Khartoum for many years, and I can feel, I understand where that energy is coming from. I feel it.
When were you in Khartoum?
Quite deeply. I was in Khartoum from 2008, 2009, all the way up to 2011, you know, 11 or 12, involved in those various processes. And what I would just like to do is to respond to your question, is to add to what they've said, namely that the continent is changing. The continent is changing. What we now begin to increasingly see, and indeed what we've seen in Sudan, is young people from different backgrounds, Muslims, Christians, interfaith. This is one of the strengths of the Sudanese civil society. Engineers, doctors, veterinarians. You know, how many times do you hear of a political movement for social change that brings together such disparate groups, disparate professional groups? So this is one of the key lessons, you know, that the Sudanese civil society indeed is demonstrating. So I think it's a continent that's changing. Young people are basically trying to craft an alternative vision of democracy that is inclusive. And what is important to note is that the Sudan Professionals Alliance and all the coalitions that are part of this initiative did not just emerge just the other day, didn't emerge yesterday. They've been around for a very, very long time. They've been organizing in 2010, in 2011. They were organizing in 2008. Many of them were even involved in the peace process, the Track 2 process between the North and the South. They made their voices heard. Mm. And, of course, they are rooted and, you know, are inspired, as Ambassador Sati was mentioning. They are inspired by the insurrections, the peaceful insurrections in 1964 against the Aboud military government, and mm-hmm. even against Nimeiri in
1985.
So I think these are lessons that the continent is changing and will change.
Is it possible that we are basically looking at a continent that is going to be liberated by the changing demographics in tandem with social media, perhaps?
No, absolutely. It's a changing demographic. It's a shifting demographic. I mean, when we were in college, and I used to watch, you know, my colleagues and I used to watch Straight Talk Africa every week. We tuned in, and in those moments, in the early to mid-90s, we were talking about young, charismatic men and women that would go and pick up arms in order to fight for change. Now the language is very different. It's not about going to the bush to pick up arms. It's about, you know, establishing that civic pressure, that civic responsibility. So I would actually call it a social struggle, but of a different form. And I think what we've seen in Sudan, what we've seen in Burkina Faso, what we saw in Algeria, what we've seen in Tunisia is really part of this larger momentum of which demographics play an extremely important role.
Well, Paul, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
A reminder that Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, during his 1 year in office, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made headlines for pushing through unprecedented reforms. But many challenges lie ahead in creating a national consensus. An in-depth discussion on the future of Ethiopia on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today we are discussing the recent social and political developments in the Sudan. And our guests today are Amar Eriateb, a Sudanese activist and a former senior staffer at the Central Bank of Sudan, Ibrahim Babiker, a Sudanese activist representing Girifina, a Sudanese movement that is committed to social, economic, and political justice, and Paul Nantulia from the Africa Center of Strategic Studies at the National Defense University here in Washington. I have to say again, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. I come to you again, Madam. You've heard that someone was actually saying that we are probably experiencing what someone would characterize as essentially like a wind of change, a sort of political wind of change. Do you believe that?
Yes, I do. And I'm really proud of what my people are doing and how they did it, like, so peacefully. I think the strength of this uprise as compared to the other previous uprises of 1964 and 1985 was the fact that the people were so determined, and the people were this, and the engine was moved by the youngest people among us, like our children, our younger brothers and sisters. Mm. And whereas I think and the women are the main participants in this revolution, though the Islamic, the laws of the country were so suppressive and oppressive to the women. And that is a point when we measure, if we want to measure the development of a country, we should measure it by the real participation of the women in the development process and the contribution of the woman, which is suppressed. But in this uprising, she insisted and she was determined to make her voice heard and to go out to the streets with her children and family all around Sudan.
I see. Ibrahim, Sudan was part of the great British Empire.
Right.
An empire where the sun never set. And yet, history tells us that back in 1960, a British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, addressed the South African Parliament in Cape Town and talked about the inevitability of the political wind of change. Mm-hmm. Are we pretty much perhaps seeing this? Because the wind of change actually began immediately after Kwame Nkrumah, the Osagyefo,
yes,
helped the then Gold Coast to regain its political independence from the British and to become Ghana on March 6, 1957.
Exactly.
And when he received the instruments of independence, he challenged the Ghanaian people by saying that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it would be linked with the total liberation of the African continent. And he did not simply talk the talk, by the way. He basically walked the talk by providing the necessary tools.
Right.
And at the end of the day, at least in terms of colonialism, 1994, when South Africa became, you know, an independent country led by the first African president, the Madiba, Nelson Mandela.
Yes, Madiba, yes.
That chapter was closed.
Yes.
Is it possible that we may very well be at the beginning of something of that magnitude?
Exactly. I mean, right now, the Sudanese people, I think, and this is something, I mean, we've learned in Sudan, I mean, but it should be across the continent of Africa, that the people hold all possibilities. They're the one who can make the change if they believe in it. They don't have to wait for any outside help or look for aspiration other than themselves. Now, this was a long time coming for us, I mean, to believe in ourselves, to understand, I mean, that we have all the possibilities. We hold the keys, I mean, to our own faith. And we can do whatever we want, I mean, with our country. And this is what draws our inspiration. I mean, we start to believe in ourselves. We start to understand that change can happen. It's not easy. It didn't come easy. But the wind of change definitely... I don't want to say, I mean, it's starting from this revolution in Sudan. I mean, there are many cases happening across the continent of Africa.
You have changes, of course, in neighboring Ethiopia. Could that also have, in a way, influenced perhaps the manner in which the Sudanese people reacted?
I don't want to say, I mean, we reacted. I mean, we probably be reacted so late. But I think the change that we are seeing the fruits of right now happened way back, I mean, in the 90s, probably, when generation after generation handed the baton to the next generation. And until now, I mean, the struggle continued. We see the fruit now, I mean, but we planted the seed a long time ago. And for social justice, social change to happen, it does take time. I do agree with Ambassador Sati that this revolution got into every house, every gender, I mean, all genders, I mean, and ages. So for that to happen, it actually took a lot of time, I mean, and effort for the people, I mean, to raise to that occasion. And I think, I mean, the last thing the best results, I mean, or in my opinion, the best result of this revolution, that it raised the bar so high for the people. Now, I mean, you cannot, I mean, whether it's a military ruler or civilian council that comes next, the people expect better. So this is a great thing.
Very interesting. Paul, you have several African rulers who have been in power, arguing that they are there because they succumbed to people's pressure, the pressure of their people, because they say that they are uniquely gifted to such an extent that they could very well say that they are perhaps God's political gifts to their countries. What would you say to those type of rulers?
Well, what I would tell them is to watch very carefully what is happening in Sudan right now, because we've heard those arguments being given to us by successive generations of Sudanese leaders. Just as Ambassador Sati was saying, just as my auntie Amal was saying just a few minutes ago, this has been the narrative. And because that has been the narrative, the energy of the people has been suppressed, and it hasn't been felt. What is happening in Sudan right now is that energy is finally being expressed. And what the people are saying is something very different from what we've heard. What they're saying is, we are the leadership, we are a nation consists of peoples. And that's the narrative. That's what is coming out of the various coalitions that we've seen in Sudan. Not just now, but as I mentioned before, this has been a long time coming. A lot of work has been done. A lot of capacity has been built. But the most important thing is the Sudanese citizens, the Sudanese civil society across the country. And if you look at the composition of the protests, it's very interesting to see the different shades of the country, the different colors of the people, different regions. It's easy to see that. And what they're saying is, look, it's a different narrative. There's no such thing as a God-given leader that is going to be in office at the benevolence of the people. No, but there is such a thing as a God-given nation and a God-given, broad civic movement that has grassroots support within the country. That is what is God-given, because ultimately that is what the nation is. This is the message that is coming out of the Sudan. And what I would say to the leaderships that you've mentioned is, have a little humility and look at what is happening in the Sudan, because it's not just relevant for that country, it's relevant for the entire continent and indeed the world, because there are struggles that are happening in other parts of the world. Young people are demanding social change, are demanding rights, are demanding dignity. So this is indeed something that's universal. It's a universal message.
You know, talking about a universal message, there was a great American president by the name Abraham Lincoln. He once described democracy as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And yet, for the most part, what we are seeing could actually be characterized on the continent as democracy being defined as a government of some people, by some people, and for some people. Is it possible that in the recent developments in Khartoum, perhaps we are actually seeing the Sudanese people reclaiming their country, reclaiming their status of being the politically primary stakeholders?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a central message. And just going back to what Ambassador Sati said, and I'm really glad he said it. As a young man early on in my career, Ambassador Sati was the top UN diplomat in Burundi during the Arusha talks. And I met him at his house, and he really inspired me. And this is precisely what we're talking about today. is what we talked about at Ambassador Sati's house in Bujumbura. So it's really very emotional. You know, I have a lot of emotion just by sharing this platform with him. But this is what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, he experienced the 64 uprising. He experienced and participated in the uprising in 1985. And he has said that men and women, Sudanese men and women of his generation, are standing by to ensure that this transition is delivered in a way that produces an inclusive vision. And this vision was developed many, many years ago and has been handed down. So, yes. So basically, what we would like to see on the African continent with governments is what the Sudanese people have been able to do. In other words, you look at the composition of the civic movement in the Sudan, there has been a handing down, systematic handing down of leadership, which is why Ambassador Sati today could say what he said, because he's not in the leadership role right now. But he is in a position where he can provide assistance.
He can advise.
Absolutely. And this is what we would like to see.
Yeah. And if I may add, I mean, to Paul's point, actually, people in Africa are asset, not liabilities. They are the true asset we have, I mean, in that continent. With them, all possibilities can happen. It's not the land, it's not the gold, it's the people, actually.
You know, there's a saying that all of life is about passion, is about action and reaction. And to ignore the passion, the action and reaction of your generation is to risk having not really lived at all, occupying space. Is it quite possible that part of the reason, frankly, that Africa is left behind is backward despite its immense wealth is because most of us are occupying space?
I believe so. I believe so. I believe that, you know, the just let's go back to the Sudan. Industrious people, industrious and dynamic civil society. I mean, I was looking at the transitional proposals of the alliance. Their vision of what should happen in these talks, their ideas of a constitutional framework, a constitutional conference for the country, what the government should look like. And these are not things that were done yesterday. They've been working on these proposals for many, many years. So that is just a demonstration to illustrate that the biggest problem that Africa has had is that its people have been shackled for too long, and it's that human resource, which is the most important resource that any country can have, and what we're seeing through experiences in the Sudan, in Burkina Faso, in Burundi, and other places, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Africans have woken up to that, and they've realized their worth. And what they're trying to do is to assert it, and I think this is one of the biggest changes, you know, that we're starting to see on the continent. And so I'm very optimistic.
Very interesting, Amar. When I was young, and that's a long time ago, because I'm now a very old guy.
No, you are not.
I used to hear politicians and leaders and those who would claim to be leaders talk about how Africa, for example, consumes what it does not produce, produces what it does not consume. And later, I had some more social and politically sophisticated rulers, they call themselves leaders, talk about how all Africa needs is to get into the business of adding value. When you have a person, frankly, who has been in power, who has had the opportunity to be in power for 30 years, and he talks the talk about adding values without walking that particular walk, walking that particular talk so that people can in fact walk the walk. What do you say to that type of person?
Actually, I think what he had said maybe have some part of a truth in it, because for us, as before, like colonization of Africa, the people used to produce their own food, and to produce what they need to survive and to trade it within the neighbors or the tribes or the villages or at the regional level. But when we were colonized, we started producing according to the priority of the colonial
cash crop.
Yes, the cash crops, and at the expense of what will keep us survive, like at the expense of producing our own food. So, and I think this is, it is a time when we need to, you spoke about the value added, but I would speak about the comparative advantage. We should first look at the comparative advantage of our nation as an African nation or as a Sudanese nation. For us, as a Sudanese nation, we are mainly an agrarian economy. We are an agricultural economy. We lived on this economy as an agrarian economy.
But even with agriculture, Africa is probably one of those few places left really in this world if it actually focused on agriculture.
Yes, sir.
It could in fact become the bread basket of the world.
Yes.
We have arable, you know, land. We have everything that God really could have given anybody.
Right.
The only problem I think we have, sincerely, we don't seem to love ourselves. We seem to be in the business of helping other countries, for example, become superpowers.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Look at China. I grew up looking at a China that was under Chairman Mao Zedong. The transport of choice in China at the time was a bicycle. And the clothes, everybody had the same, you know, the same cloth. But today, you go to Beijing. China now has the distinction of having the second largest economy, and it will soon be number one. And part of the reason it is in the position it is because, essentially, it benefits from us.
Right.
When you talk about being the world factory, for example, today, where does it get the oil from? Nigeria. Angola, Gabon, you name it. Where does it get the copper, the cobalt, the coltan, all those kinds of things?
And yet, material.
When you go to places in Africa which where these precious minerals, for example, are extracted, you cannot believe that those people probably even depend on a sweet potato economy.
Right.
So where is the leadership, really? Is it possible that, in fact, we have a leadership deficit?
You said it right there. I mean, we have a leadership and management problem. We mismanage our resources. We mismanage our conflicts. We can't, I mean, have a dialogue, I mean, between us so we can better invest in ourselves rather than benefiting everyone else. So it's right there. I mean, the leadership, I mean, the management of resources, I mean, having everybody, I mean, understand, I mean, what we need and how we can improve ourselves first before, I mean, we even think about, I mean, exporting raw material and waiting for international aid coming back to us. So it's a long discussion. I mean, maybe we're in the first step in Sudan, but we definitely, hopefully, I mean, we're on the right track to resolve these.
You know, Paul, there was a great man from what was known as British Guyana, Walter Rodney.
Yes.
He came up with this classic book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. You know, maybe he could in fact have written another one, a sequel of sorts, saying how Africa developed Europe.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no denying it. There's no denying it. The role that the continent has played in the development of other societies, in the development of Europe, in the development of North America, where we're sitting, but also in the development of Asia, in the development of China.
Precisely.
North
America.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so for me, it's the crisis is not necessarily one of leadership, because I think we see leadership today in the Sudan with the civic movement,
right,
and with other movements,
right,
the
right.
civic movement in Burundi, in Ghana, in Nigeria. There's leadership there.
How do we consolidate that?
I think we need to be able to, which is why I argued initially that the leaderships at the governmental level should be looking at what is happening in places like the Sudan to learn lessons, because it is essentially harnessing that talent, creating a policy framework that enables that talent to thrive, creating a policy framework where the African citizen feels like a real citizen,
right,
and feels that the skills and the expertise that are invested in for so many years will be used to develop that country.
But is that going to be possible if the vast majority, for example, of the Africans really do not reclaim their citizenship? Because for now, they are really, for the most part, treated by their rulers as subjects who do not have rights.
Correct.
Who depend on privileges granted to them by these individual authorities.
Correct, correct. And so it's a continuation, more or less.
How do you bring about social, political consciousness?
I think that we're getting there as a continent. We're getting there as a continent. If we look at all these different experiences, and we look at what these protest movements are articulating, they are saying precisely that. They are saying, first of all, we are from the continent. We are of the continent. We're loyal to the continent. We're loyal to these principles.
Mm.
We're citizens, and we must assert. We must assert our sovereignty, and as my brother Ibrahim was saying, we're not going to wait for other people to assert that sovereignty for us, including our political leaderships.
Mm.
So I think that is the message that is coming out, and with or without a success of the outcome, because over the past couple of days, we've talked about sort of the Egyptian scenario. Could it happen? Could these processes be hijacked? Just to use the words that have been coming up in the press, the way I look at it is, in the process of demanding for rights, demanding for open government, demanding for inclusive government,
what about
African citizens are being educated?
What about demanding that Africans carry out credible elections, not selections? Because at one time, there were a lot of coups. Now you can no longer do business as usual with a coup. Why can't the international community also say, unless you conduct a credible election that is transparent, verifiable election that has the result that is a reflection of the will of the people, not the will of the individual who counts, who announces the results, so who counts the vote, we are not going to do business as usual with you. What about that?
Well, that would be ideal, but I think it needs to come from the African continent.
Unfortunately,
first and foremost.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally, and on that note, our guests today were Omar Al-Tayeb, Ibrahim Babiker, and Paul Nantaria, reporter Naba Mohideen, and Ambassador Nur Eldin Sati joined us earlier from Khartoum. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa, and remember to keep the African hopes alive.
Thank you so much.